Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A recent article in the Wall Street Journal caught our attention, headlined, Scientists Search for the Best Sleepers, Working to Unravel the Secrets of Sleep Gene by Gene. At a lab at the University of California, San Francisco, a husband and wife team working to unravel the secrets of sleep. And we're going to be speaking with one of those researchers this hour of the program. Dr. Louis Potacek is with us, professor of neurology and director of the neurogenetics division at UC San Francisco School of Medicine. He is a leader in the field of neurogenetics, and his work studying epilepsy, migraines, and cardiac arrhythmias has led him to studying sleep, sleeping patterns, and our internal circadian clocks. He hopes to begin testing for drugs that could alter the body's circadian rhythms, internal clocks that influence virtually all of our biological markers, from sleeping and eating to cardiovascular function. And if we had such a drug, it could perhaps treat jet lag, or it could enhance the curative powers of cancer treatments. We should also say, yet another guest, it's amazing how many people went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our guest did, and he is from Wisconsin and used to listen to WPR. So how about that? So we'll be talking about sleep. We all do this. We all sleep or we don't sleep, and it's a fascinating topic, so I'm sure we're going to get a lot of calls. Let me tell you how you can enter the conversation. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K. Dunn Show. Dr. Potacek, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah. So you're from Wisconsin as well?
I am. I went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
It's amazing how many fine thinkers in this world have done just that, sir.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. This sleep thing is so interesting. I'm wondering, I was just talking about this to somebody, and it's slightly off our topic, but it is related to sleep. Why is it that we have to sleep so much? Do you know why we sleep this huge portion of our lives away?
It's really pretty remarkable. We, on average, we sleep about a third of our lives, and we still don't know what sleep really is or why we need to do it.
Is it important for us to know that?
Well, absolutely. We do know that if we don't sleep well, or if we're chronically sleep deprived or chronically out of sync with our, you know, clock and our solar day, that we have higher risks of cancer and autoimmune disease, obesity, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's critically important that we understand it, not only because it's just interesting, but because understanding sleep better and helping people to sleep better will have a huge impact on human health.
You're doing a great deal of study of our internal circadian clocks. Can you tell me, what's a circadian clock?
So our planet is revolving on its axis once every 24 hours, very close to once every 24 hours. And so through evolution, we and all other living things on this planet have evolved so that we can function maximally in a situation where the light and dark cycles are oscillating every day, and coincident with changes in light and dark are also changes in temperatures. And so being able to function maximally, to function really well with those changing cycles, is important for us to be successful, healthy, and happy.
Mm-hmm. And we all have, it's a very unique thing, everybody has his or her own circadian rhythm.
Well, we all have a circadian rhythm that's approximately 24 hours. So circadian comes from the Latin circa diem, circa meaning around and diem being a day, so around a day. And most living things don't have a clock that ticks at exactly 24 hours. Rather, we as humans tend to have a clock that's a little longer than 24 hours, and we have to reset a little each morning with the bright light that we get early in our solar day. Mice, on the other hand, have a period typically that's a little less than 24 hours, and so they have to adjust in the opposite direction so that they can live on a 24-hour day. They have to delay a little each day. We have to, as humans, we have to advance a little each day.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be make sense for most of us to think that the sun comes up and the sun goes down, and that's the natural time for us to go to sleep and to get up?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the cavemen and women did that. And if you've been camping, Kathleen, you know that when you're out in the woods and you don't have TV and you don't have radio and you don't have artificial lights, we tend to, you know, go to sleep in our tents not so long after the sun goes down. Excuse me. And tend much more than during the, you know, rest of our year to be getting up when the sun comes up. So we listen to our clock more precisely, I think, when we're living in a situation that's more akin to what our cavemen and women ancestors used to do.
Mm-hmm. I know that you're working on with your wife on various aspects of sleep. Part of what you're looking at is, and I believe you're studying a whole group of people on this, which would be interesting to hear about those studies, but you're looking at circadian rhythms. Are you looking at circadian rhythms to find out how they will affect the body in terms of fighting disease or in terms of giving drugs for disease, that there might be an optimal time to give medication? What does the circadian rhythm have to do with that?
Well, we're working on a number of different things. And what we're focusing on, first of all, is trying to understand the normal variation in the general population for people who tend to be morning larks, night owls, or in between,
uh-huh.
and for people to be short sleepers, to require less sleep or to require more sleep. And we know that there's a normal distribution of the preferred biological wake-up times and the preferred biological sleep amounts that is required. So we're trying to just understand the very basics of what controls that with the long-term view that then we'll be in a better position to develop better jet lag drugs, for example, or maybe one day to have a drug that can allow us to sleep less and to feel well rested.
Mm.
But we know that people who are out of sync with their clock, like women, for example, or men, that women that have been a subject of studies who are chronically working the night shift as nurses in hospitals. And these women are at a statistically significantly increased risk of breast cancer.
Really?
And other cancers as well. And the same is true for men, although I think the biggest studies have really been done in female nurses and looking at breast cancer. We also know that the time that you get your chemotherapy, if you have breast cancer, the time in your circadian day affects the prognosis and your, you know, outcome from treatments for breast cancer.
Really?
So if we, no, they're not huge numbers. It's not like you're at a 10-time increased risk for breast cancer if you're a chronic shift worker. But with numbers as large as there are in the population that have been studied, there is a statistically significant increase in risk.
Hmm.
So understanding how the clock works and being able to reset it more precisely, just like we do our walkers when we fly across time zones, might allow us, for example, to align the treatment of the chemotherapy with the time of day when it will have the best effect of killing cancer cells and the least effect in killing our normal healthy cells
right.
that get the side effects from chemotherapy.
Right. And what's the association between third shift workers and breast cancer? Why is it more prevalent among nurses who work that shift?
Nobody knows, but it's clear with breast cancer and with other cancers, with women and men, that if we're living out of sync with our biological clock, that is not healthy. We have increased risk for cancer, for obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and autoimmune disorders, and on and on.
Hmm.
But we don't understand why that is.
So if you were going to give advice to people about what you ought to do in order to biologically be as healthy as possible, be in touch with your circadian rhythms, would your advice be go to bed shortly after dark and get up when the sun rises and you'll be healthier?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that if we live on, not every day, you know, each of us has deadlines we have to meet and responsibilities with our families and our friends. But in general, I think it is important to get good quality sleep and to sleep when our bodies are telling us to.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you have to work the shift, the night shift, it's possible to shift your clock, but that means that you want to sleep during the daylight. And then it's important to have a really dark bedroom to sleep in so that you can shift your clock. And it takes a while to do that, but shift our clock so that we can be, so our bodies really think that, you know, the sun is coming up even though we're going to work at 11 o'clock. We have the benefit of bright lights, electric lights that cavemen and women didn't. And so it's possible to entrain our clocks or just reset our clocks to the new time if we're a shift worker. But doing that effectively requires that we get really good quality sleep during the day in a dark room and that we have bright light during the night when we're working.
Mm-hmm. This article that we mentioned in the Wall Street Journal, I found this amazing, said that less than 1% of Americans need less than 6 hours of sleep a night. That's not very many people. You and your wife have studied those people, haven't you?
Dr. Fu, my spouse, Dr. Fu, and I have been working with people who are even more extreme than that. Certainly, there are people in the population who require only 4 hours of sleep.
Wow.
But it's a normal distribution. Now, you and I can live on a small number of hours of sleep per night for a few days or for a couple of weeks even if we have, you know, a stressful job and an important project that needs to be done. But I'm talking about people who for their entire life can live on 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, and when they wake up in the morning they feel fully refreshed and seem to function at a very high level. So it's a normal distribution. And most people are closer to 8.5 hours. That's kind of the median or the middle of the curve. But there are people who require a lot more, and there are people who require a lot less. And the farther you go out on the tails of that normal curve, the smaller and smaller the percentage of the population will fall into that category.
So you're looking at their genetic structure to find out why their sleep patterns are as they are?
So what Dr. Fu and I have done is to identify families who are apparently normal, healthy families, as far as we can tell, but who are very extreme in their sleep patterns. So for the shifted people, the morning larks, we're talking about people who for their entire life spontaneously wake up at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And when we find people like that and they meet those criteria, and this is tricky, this is very hard work for us to do because all of us, you know, type A personalities, you know, are driven and they get up early, maybe even if their clock is not telling them to get up early. So we have to dissect away all of the familial, cultural, psychosocial factors that impact us in a way that we sleep differently from what our clock is telling us. But there are people who are extreme morning larks. They feel best when they get up early and they go to sleep early. And when we look at those real extremes, they almost always have a strong family history.
Uh-huh.
That is to say, it passes from generation to generation, suggesting that there's a single gene and a mutation in that gene that causes those people to be morning larks.
Interesting.
Similarly, we have families that have extreme night owl phenotypes, and those look in very extreme cases like single gene defects and single gene mutations, natural short sleepers and natural long sleepers.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to be able to get by on just 3 hours?
I think it would be great. I spend you know, so much time writing grants and papers and, you know, working in the lab. And spending time with my you know, family and my son. If I had more hours in the day to do, you know, to do work and to have quality time with my family, if I felt well rested, I think that would be great.
Wouldn't you want to take a little nap to shut everything out for a while?
Fair enough.
Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And our guest this hour is Dr. Louis Potacek. He's a professor of neurology, director of the neurogenics division at the University of California, San Francisco. We're talking about the work that he and his wife are doing concerning sleep. It is fascinating. They're looking at very, very short sleepers. Can you imagine 3 hours a night? They're looking at people who go to bed when the sun goes down and get up very early in the morning, and many people in the family do the same thing. Their work is important for a study of circadian rhythms and also may be able to give us a pill to not only sleep less and feel fully refreshed, but counter jet lag and determine the best time of day to administer medications. That's interesting, isn't it? To your phone calls momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls as we talk about sleep this hour. And Vivian in Green Bay, our first caller. Hi, Vivian.
Hello.
Hi.
7.5 months ago, at the age of 68, I had a total hip replacement. General anesthesia, the normal pain medications for an appropriate time thereafter. Prior to that, I had no trouble sleeping. And I cannot recapture a good night's sleep, even though I'm vigorously active, even more so, because I retired a year ago and I'm outdoors working all the time. I just cannot get a good night's sleep.
Well, Vivian, this is an increasing problem for all of us as we get older. And, of course, having gone through a major surgery is quite disruptive for our bodies, and so it's not surprising that that could disrupt your clock. But our clocks are able to reset, and so, you know, my hope would be that you should be able to get back to a good, healthy sleeping schedule. It's surprising that that hasn't happened already 7.5 months out, but, you know, the things that I would recommend, of course, are all the things that help us all sleep better: exercising, being active, as you said you are, not eating a big meal, you know, within a few hours before bedtime, sleeping in a dark, quiet room, not being distracted. You know, frequently people can have trouble sleeping if they're reading something really exciting before they're going to bed. So reading something more mundane, if you like to read in bed, is a better way to help you get prepared to sleep. But getting the bright light in the early morning to help you get up and not having bright light in the evening, these are all things that can help each of us sleep a little better, whether we've had surgery or not.
It is a huge problem in this country, isn't it, getting a good night's sleep?
Well, we as Americans, people in this country and elsewhere in the world require, on average, 8 to 8.5 hours of sleep to feel good and to really function optimally. In fact, we as Americans get typically, you know, 7 to 7.5 hours of sleep per night. So we are a sleep-deprived society, and that's, you know, that's part of our social construct and our social system. You know, teenagers, for example, tend to be more night owlish for reasons that we don't know, but perhaps because of the hormonal changes. And yet, you know, school start times are all typically 8 o'clock in the morning, when many kids, you know, would be better off and feel better if they were allowed to sleep a little longer. And so we are a chronically sleep deprived society, and I think if bear some attention how we can sleep more healthily and in better sync with our circadian clocks.
Yeah, because of the link, too, that you describe between poor sleep or weird sleep patterns and disease. It's something that we need to pay more attention to.
Oh, absolutely. People who are themselves night owl people can have an increased risk for obesity, and we don't understand why that is, but it is, in fact, true. And so, you know, another important health element in sleep and circadian function would be, you know, that we're getting food and, you know, eating and living our lives during the time of day when we're, you know, going to do best and not gaining lots of extra weight and increase our risk for diabetes, for example.
Let's go next. Thank you, Vivian. Brian in Madison. Hello.
Pardon me, I was on the speaker. You know, first off, a comment. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing up the relevant information regarding third shift workers and you know, dangerous illnesses. I believe some of that information started coming out in the beginning of the 2000s, and I'm always grateful when other people bring it up because I feel like I'm the only person. But for myself, I've had, since I was young, quite a few different mental health diagnoses. And for myself, that all changed when I was about 22. And after working as a baker for a number of years, realized that for myself, getting between 3 to 5 hours of sleep a night was ideal. And that actually, if I got more sleep than that, it made it harder for me to be socially functional. It made it harder for me to choose not to moderate my mental states with substances. It's been a tremendous blessing for me to realize that actually, I am a happier person and more functional, although I will admit it's been challenging with romantic relationships to not sleep very much.
Well, you got a lot more hours, too. You have a lot more time to fill in the day. Well, that's interesting. There's one of those one percenters, people who just don't need much sleep at all, Doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. It is interesting that this gentleman raises you know, psychiatric issues. We do know that people who have bipolar disease, manic depression, are at increased risk for having an attack if they are sleep deprived or if they're out of sync. You know, it's interesting that this gentleman mentions that if he sleeps too much, he doesn't feel as well. This is something that I don't understand, but I know that if I spend too much time in bed, you know, not only does my back ache, but I also don't feel great. And so there is an issue of you know, the issue of getting up and being active is really important. And when our clocks are telling us to be awake, we are healthier and happier in general if we're out and about and we're getting exercise and we're being physically active. And so spending too much time in bed, I don't know if it has bad, I don't know if there have been any studies about, you know, bad health consequences of that. But I know from personal experience, and this gentleman has nicely voiced his own experience where he and I, neither of us feel as good when we spend too much time in bed. So,
right.
So getting enough sleep is important, but getting out and being active in the world is also part of our healthy life, of a healthy lifestyle.
Yes. Thank you, Brian, for the call. This pill that you mentioned that would allow all of us to sleep less is quite a ways down the future, isn't it? The article said 10 years, maybe?
Oh, yeah. There's no way to predict. Because of things that we learned from studying our very first family with familial advanced sleep phase, FASP is the term we use to describe these families with extreme morning larks. We've learned some very basic fundamental biochemical principles of the circadian clock that have indicated to us one way that we think we might be able to tweak the clock or reset it using small molecules, chemical compounds that could become medicine. And so knowing if that will work and how long it will take, you know, I can't even begin to predict. But it is clear that we can only make dramatic progress through better understanding of how the clock works in the first place. And we've made some very significant gains in that regard.
Mm-hmm. We'll take more phone calls. If you're wondering about the noise in the background, Dr. Potocnik is leaving for China, and in about an hour, he and his wife, they're speaking at several universities about their work. So that's what you're hearing. You're hearing speakers telling them about flights, et cetera. Let's go next to David in South Milwaukee. Hello, David.
Hello. Thank you for the program and such a fine guest.
You're welcome.
I'm wondering, Doctor, if you're familiar with polyphasic sleeping, and it, just briefly, it's described in the 4-Hour Body by Tim Ferriss, in which one can cut one's sleep by an hour and a half, and for each hour and a half, you make up for it with a 20-minute nap at 4-hour intervals. So if I were to cut down to 3 hours from 7.5, that would be three times 20-minute naps during the day. And he said that when he tried it, and another person tried it in his book, that they felt really great. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with it, if it's actually possible for someone to do.
Yeah, I don't really know. I'm not aware of any really good data proving that to be true. But it is clear. Let me first speak about mice. When we look at mouse rest activity rhythms, which we use as a surrogate, activity being a surrogate for wakefulness and inactivity as a surrogate for sleep, it's very clear that if we look at different strains of mice, that they have different, very different patterns. Some are very active, you know, when they in the beginning of their day and then become inactive and then have a lot of activity at the end of their day. Some are mostly active at the beginning of their day and less so later, and vice versa, and everything in between. And so this clearly is something that's genetic. Different organization of activity rhythms through the mouse's night, which is their, you know, the dark period is their day, their nocturnal animals. So we do know that there are strong genetic contributions to different patterns of sleep and activity rhythms in mice. I have no doubt that that may be true in humans, but I would be willing to bet that it's not true that we can train ourselves to sleep on some bizarre schedule if our body is not really biologically tuned to do that. Now, there have been stories that I've heard, and I don't know how well documented they are, that people like Michelangelo or maybe it was Leonardo, I can't remember, you know, great men and women from the past who slept on very bizarre schedules and functioned very well. I don't doubt that that works for some people. What I would say is that, you know, if it works for you and you feel good, then that's great. I can't argue with that.
Yeah. And I know it was Michelangelo was one of them, because I had a week's vacation and I decided to study Michelangelo for the week. So,
good for you.
Yeah, he was a guy who didn't sleep very much at all. Just was too excited about what he was doing. You would also feel a lot of pressure, wouldn't you, if you had to fall asleep during that 20-minute nap? You'd be saying, "Oh, I got to sleep! I got to sleep! I got to sleep! I only have 20 minutes."
Well, you know, we have two elements. We have the biological clock ticking in our brain, but we also have something called the sleep homeostat. And what that means is that we are, the longer we're awake, we become more and more tired. And we don't, again, understand why that is, but it's clear. Mm-hmm. We all know that to be true. And so if we travel to Europe from the United States, and where the clock is 7, 8, 9 hours ahead, if we stay up and stay up and stay up in Amsterdam, say, if we travel to the Netherlands, then we can still go to sleep on Netherlands time because we're sleep deprived, even though our clock is telling us that it's not time to go to sleep. So we can use tiredness as a, so if you're tired because you've been up for, you know, a long time, and then you lay down and take a power nap, I've certainly done that, and I sometimes feel great after taking a power nap.
Yeah.
But to do that chronically, I think is probably not healthy for most of us, unless there's some genetic difference in that in a person who makes them more inclined to function well under that schedule.
How are you going to handle your sleep with this China trip?
Well, I'm going to, not eat too much, not drink too much alcohol, try to get some work done in the first few hours, maybe watch a movie, and then get a little bit of a nap. But when we arrive in China about 20 hours from now, it will be evening time. So I'll want to make, I'll want to be sleep deprived. I'll want to be able to stay up for a good part of the trip so that I'm really sleep deprived when I get there. Because if I'm sleep deprived, I can go to sleep regardless of what my circadian clock is telling me to do.
Oh, that makes sense. Let's thank you very much, David, for your call. And let us go to Lisa in Janesville. Hi.
Hi. I have had a lot of trouble sleeping, probably for over 10 years. I can fall asleep, and I think I'm sleeping all night. I had a sleep study done about 5 years ago, and it came back as periodic limb movement disorder. So I'm twitching all night long. I was prescribed gabapentin. It never helped. But, I wake up and I'm tired all day. I just kind of feel low energy. And when I came back with the sleep study, my husband said, well, I could have told you you'd done that. That's why I moved to the other side of the bed. So every now and then I check if there's any updates about this, if there's any new medications, and I never really see anything about it.
Well, let me say, first of all, that while I'm a neurologist and specialize in a number of areas, including sleep and circadian phenotypes, I don't take care of the general sleep disorder patient. But that said, I can tell you that the very common sleep disorders that many of us know and that you know include restless leg syndrome, which you're describing, which affects, I'm not sure what the numbers are, perhaps 1% of the population or more. Obstructive sleep apnea, people who are snoring and, not getting enough oxygen during certain periods because they can actually stop breathing for periods of time. And then, of course, just generally, there is insomnia that can happen for many reasons. If we're really stressed out from work or from family problems or whatever, that can lead us to not sleep well. So these are well-known sleep disorders, and these are abnormal. These are unhealthy, and good sleep doctors can help with better treatments for that. What we've really focused on more are normal variations that lead people to just be, apparently healthy sleepers but extreme morning larks, apparently healthy sleepers but extreme night owls, or apparently healthy sleepers who just require a lot less sleep. So, so there's a difference between the normal variation in the population, which we don't know to be associated with any ill health effects, and sleep disorders like restless leg or obstructive sleep apnea that good sleep doctors can often help us with through either treatments with medication or behavioral treatments. Good sleep hygiene, as I mentioned earlier, not eating close to bedtime, not getting stressed out or excited before trying to go to bed, sleeping in a dark room, getting up with the light in the morning and getting a bright light, being active during the day, exercising. Those are all things that can help all of us, regardless of whether we have sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, or we're generally just healthy sleepers. Mm.
I'm wondering if you or anybody else, Doctor, has studied babies and sleeping. I've always, every time I see a baby who can just fall sound asleep in the middle of a circus or a parade that's going on, it's astounding to me. And I'm wondering what happens if we know what happens physically within that little body that allows it and perhaps requires it to shut down frequently during a day. Can we learn from that sleep?
Yeah, I'm sure we can. I don't know much about that. We do know that infants sleep a lot more than we do when we grow to adulthood. We require a little bit less sleep as we get to be 60 and 70 than we did when we were younger. But what is it that allows our children when they're babies to sleep so soundly when there's all kinds of activity around them? I don't know. You know, when I was a postdoc and working in the laboratory 16, 18 hours a day, I could go out into the atrium and sit on a recliner and fall asleep, and nothing could wake me up.
Mm.
So I, you know, healthy sleep is allows us to sleep through things that, you know, as I've gotten older, my sleep is less deep, and I think that's typical for people. We tend to sleep less restfully and less deeply as we get older than we did when we were young. But as I said before, being active during the day, for example, always helps me and lots of other people sleep more deeply in the evening. So we can affect the depth of our sleep just by being active and healthy, eating a healthy diet, et cetera, living without too much stress in our lives, et cetera.
Right. Thank you, Lisa, for the call. Jean in Washburn. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. In the late 70s, I had the opportunity to be reading all the monthly journals of, you know, Lancet, JAMA, Modern Medicine, et cetera. One of the studies that I read, and I thought it was coming out of San Fran, was that there seemed to be a strong correlation between high IQ and the lessened need for sleep. And I was wondering if Dr. Potocnik was aware of that study in the late 70s, or if anything's been done to duplicate it since, or to, you know, is it just bunk?
I'm sorry, but I don't know whether that's true or not. I'm not familiar with that study. I can tell you that people that in the families that we've studied who require, where, you know, many of the individuals require less sleep and seem to, you know, feel fine without sleeping, you know, more than 6 or 5 hours a day, it does seem that these people tend to be very successful. And so whether this is just because they have more hours to do things, or whether there's some link between the genetics that regulates our sleep requirement and behavioral phenotypes like type A go-getter personality versus type B laid-back or lazy personality, like some people we know, I simply can't say. But that doesn't surprise me. But whether that study was well done, I can't say because I'm not familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jean, very much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guest and his wife are looking at the secrets of sleep by studying our genes, and they're looking specifically at those who are early to bedders, early to risers, those who are night owls, and also looking at the very small part of the American population that needs very, very little sleep, and finding out if there's some kind of drug we can take by a study of genetics that would allow all of us, if we so choose, to get by on 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. So that's what we're talking about this hour. Dr. Louis Potocnik is a professor of neurology and director of the neurogenetics division at the UC San Francisco School of Medicine, a leader in the field of neurogenetics. And he studies epilepsy, migraines, cardiac arrhythmias, and his study of those areas has led him to a study of sleep, sleep patterns, and our internal circadian clocks. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A couple of Facebook messages have come in. Let's go to one or two if we can. A caller who requires less sleep is really concerned about how socially unacceptable it is. People think you're on drugs or speed or something. The caller has had a hard time conforming to what people expect of him. He wishes people would stop thinking him crazy or a drug addict.
Well, this is an interesting observation. It is true that we all tend to make judgments about people sleeping. If they sleep late, that they're lazy, for example, which sometimes is true, but often is not. Some people work very late in the night because they feel good doing that and then consequently want to sleep late the next day. You know, I work very hard when we're talking about the subjects that we study, not to make any sort of judgment, but rather to just explore what their normal biological pattern is. But this is true. It can be a real problem. The first subject who came to our attention, an extreme morning lark, was really quite depressed. And she was depressed, I think, because people said, oh, you're being antisocial. You never come out to the dinner parties. You're depressed. You get up early in the morning. You're just depressed. And she, I think, came to believe this and feel that way because people didn't take her seriously.
Hmm.
And when we published the first paper reporting her family and the first paper reporting the first human gene and so forth, and the mouse models that carry the human mutation and have a phenotype much like hers, she felt much better. She felt vindicated or justified in her biological pattern, a pattern that she knew was her pattern, but that other people sometimes have trouble accepting. So,
right.
So I think it is important for us to try not to judge people based on, you know, the biology of their sleeping patterns.
Yeah. Well, the more we talk, the more I think you ought to have a questionnaire before people decide to settle down with somebody, because you could have a partner who had a completely opposite schedule and you'd never see him or her.
Well, some people, have suggested that this might be, you know, a real problem for some couples. And my response is, well, for some couples, it might really help. So,
it's true.
It is true. We have to figure out, we're all different, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the way that we sleep and in lots of other ways. And in relationships, we have to figure those things out and, you know, find people that we, you know, can live with and respect and appreciate and who can live with and respect and appreciate us. And that's one of the great things about being human beings and living on this planet.
It is indeed. Let's go to Sarah in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was wondering if there's any ill health effects from getting too much sleep. I seem to need like 12 hours of sleep. I've been checked by a doctor. The only thing I have going on is a hypothyroid, but I just feel lazy. I'm tired all the time, and I just require so much sleep.
Well, that may just be your normal pattern. Now, certainly someone who's hypothyroid will tend to be low energy and want to sleep more. So it's critical that your endocrinologist is looking after you and making sure that you're getting appropriate thyroid replacement. Not too much, not too little. But if you're well balanced with regard to your thyroid treatment, and if you continue to require 12 hours of sleep to feel really good, then that may just be your biological, you know, destiny.
Mm.
And if that's true, then, you know, my advice is to live, you know, to live in the constraints of your, you know, biological sleeping patterns to the best of your ability, to try to, you know, adjust your days in a way that, you know, you do get good the sleep that you require so that you can be productive and happy and healthy during the day when you're awake.
Thanks, Sarah. Nathan in Madison. Hi. Nathan, are you there?
Oh, hello. Yes,
hi.
I'm here.
Go right ahead.
Just with a story of my own, I guess. I was in college and I came back from some military training, and I was away for the training for about 6 months. And after the training, during the training, I was probably awake from 4 a.m. to late in the evening, probably about 11 o'clock p.m., so
oh,
really, really a small amount of sleep. And I came back and tried to adjust, and I would have incredible headaches just coming back into a regular schedule. And it took a long time until I could adjust back to kind of waking up at 7 and going back to bed around 9, 10. So, I don't know.
Yeah, clearly if we're out of sync with what our clock is telling us to do, we're at increased risk for, you know, pain syndromes, including a headache. It is interesting that you've had this experience. It's not surprising to me. It's not the case that we can really train ourselves to be different than what our biology is telling us. And yet, we know that, you know, Wisconsin farmers, for example, some of the people who, you know, work harder than, most others, often having to get up, you know, 3, 4 in the morning to
milk the cows and tending to go to bed earlier. You know, this is a profession that, you know, if you're born into that family and you work on the family farm and you're, you know, scheduled, and your schedule biologically is to be a night owl, well, you have to adjust to fit into that environment. And consequently, you're going to be living a little bit out of sync with your biology much of the time. But we overcome things like that when we have to be on a different sleep schedule. But our body is not always happy about it. But to my knowledge, it's not possible to train the clock in such a way that you can then live that way for the rest of your life, and you can't change your biology. Our parents, when we were children, told us when we had to go to bed. And in a way, through our genes, they continue to tell us when to go to bed even today.
Right. And just a question about genes. If you have, is there a dominant gene? If you've got a night owl dad and an early riser mom, are you more likely to be a night owl or an early riser, or it's 50-50?
It depends. If a parent has one of the mutations that we've studied and that we've characterized that causes people to be a morning lark, then that mutation would tend to make, you know, would make the people, the children who inherit it, 50% of the children who get that, to be morning larks like their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So you could imagine that there was a mutation in one family that caused people to be night owls, and that's your dad. And in another family, a mutation that caused people to be morning larks, and that's your mom. We simply don't know what happens. And when we don't know what would happen if you inherited the night owl gene from your dad and your morning lark gene from your mom.
Mm-hmm.
But I presume that you might end up being sort of average then. but this is something that, you know, we can do eventually. Once we've got genes and mutations that cause night owls, we can
right.
take our animal models of the morning lark mutations and mix, you know, cross them and intermingle them in mice. This is why experiments in animals can be so important in helping us to understand things, because of course we can't tell our human subjects who they're supposed to mate with.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we could, it would take way too many years to study the children. So those are kinds of questions that we can answer later on, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's true, just like height, you know, the genetics of height, there can be single genes that cause you to be very short or very tall, but mostly the genetics is more complex. And so that's why it is true that most children fall somewhere in between the height of their mother and father. Now, they can be taller than either parent or shorter than either parent, but on average, children tend to be intermediate in height between their dad and mom. And I think the same is probably going to be true with regard to sleep patterns, because in the general population, most of the variation is not single gene mutations, but a combination of many small genetic effects that came to me from my dad's side, plus the ones that came to me from my mom's side.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you ever so much for being with us. It was fascinating. Have a great time in China.
Okay, well, Kathleen, let me say I've spent many years listening to WPR when I lived in Wisconsin, and I congratulate you and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us. And Wisconsin has graduated a lot of good people. They find their way back here to be on the radio show. Dr. Louis Ptáček, professor of neurology, director of the neurogenetics division of the UC San Francisco School of Medicine. His work studying epilepsy, migraines, cardiac arrhythmias has led him to studying sleep. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where, by golly, the sun is finally shining. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.